Good morning.
Whoa, good morning.
I think our audience will be coming in over time. If, like myself, they were out a little bit late last night enjoying the conversations with new colleagues, so we'll give them a few moments to trickle in, and they may be coming in as we chat. Just a few housekeeping items to start. First is we'd like you to turn off your mobile phones. Not that we don't want you to be on Twitter and say how exciting this session is, but just to keep your focus. And when we get to the point where we're sitting, this is a little bit of a different session. It's not your typical panel session that you may have gone to over the course of the last couple of days. But you'll see the way that we've tried to structure the table. We're actually going to be breaking down into smaller groups with the speakers and myself each facilitating dialogues at the table, which will explain, you may be shifting yourself once we explain what the particular topic tables will be. But get comfortable for now, and we'll see how that works. I'm Christine Ibsinger. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Ian Co., which is an investment company that provides services and capital to clean energy businesses in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And you've joined us this morning to have a conversation, a series of conversations, around the issue of how do you provide value and guidance on the strategic issues and decision points in the transition that a social enterprise will make to a more growth and commercial-oriented platform. Our hope is that over the next 90 minutes, myself and the speakers, who I'll introduce momentarily, will provide you with input to the strategic rationale to the growth of your particular social enterprise or interest. I want to do a little bit of a disclaimer right up front, which is our goal is to provide you with insights from our collective experience so that it could inform you on your paths to securing growth capital. Unfortunately, you're not going to leave this room with the magical list of who those sources of funds are, what their phones or email addresses are, but rather the kinds of questions and issues that you should be thinking about as you approach them. We hope that you'll leave with an understanding of the questions that you need to ask yourself and your organization as you explore the transition strategies that will drive your growth and the resultant impact that will come from that growth. I can guarantee you from my own experience that your future investors will also be looking for the answers to those questions. So it's really fundamental that you really start from a basis of figuring out what you know and what you don't know. The way we're going to organize the session is the panel will have about 20 to 25 minutes of opening remarks and comments around the topic of tapping into social finance for growth. Then we'll break into four specific topic tables that will be facilitated by myself and the speakers. Then we'll come back up here and report back on some of the conversations around those tables and have some closing comments. Just in order to get a feel of who's in the room, if I could ask how many of you here are representing nonprofit organizations? Okay, about a quarter. Yeah, a quarter. What about for-profit organizations? Okay. How many of you have actually been able to receive debt or equity thus far, regardless of your legal personality? And then my last question, which is how many of you are looking to transform your particular organization to a more commercial platform for growth? Okay, great. Super. Well, with that, just to kind of guide us a little bit on who we're talking to in the room, what I have the pleasure of doing right now is introducing three individuals who I wish I had met 14 years ago. When Ian Co. was founded, so that I had the opportunity to learn from the wisdom that I hope they're going to be sharing with you over the next 90 minutes. It's a really interesting group of people up here. We have the investment banking community represented. We have someone who spent 30 years in the multilateral sector. We have a for-profit company and a nonprofit company. So most of the sectors that play in this space are represented here and sharing our perspectives and our experience space. I'm going to just introduce each one and then we'll go through their opening remarks. I'd like to start by introducing Harold Rosen, who's the executive director of the Grassroots Business Fund. Harold spent 30 years at the International Finance Corporation, and he spent those years working on three areas that are really core and the cornerstones of social enterprise, which is microfinance, technical assistance, and small and medium enterprises. For those of you who might have attended the session yesterday on aid agencies and listened when Rachel Kite was making her comments as a vice president at the IFC, she talked about how when she sits with us and we use the words of social entrepreneurs and social enterprise and impact investing, that when she actually goes back into her organization, she can't use any of that nomenclature. She has to translate it into the language of business. And listening and knowing Harold and listening to what he's achieved over the last 30 years, I can imagine the war wounds that he must have in the fact that he was living that translation on a daily basis. And so it's going to be very interesting to hear from him today as he shares some of the experiences of being a social entrepreneur in a very, sometimes some would say, a non-entrepreneurial international finance institution. I've also had the pleasure of working with Harold over the years, with the recent years, with the Aspen Network of Development Entrepreneurs, which is a fairly new year-old organization that's focusing specifically on developing small and growing businesses and attempting to integrate both the for-profit investment dialogue along with the issues around social enterprise and impact investing. On the corner, we have Bim Hundell, who's the founding partner and chairman of Lionshead Global Partners, an investment bank that's focused on emerging markets and development. And one of the areas that Bim's going to share with us today is his experience in actually using capital markets to focus on development objectives. And I had an opportunity to hear a couple of stories and experiences that he's had over the last years in actually applying tools of investment banking, traditional financial products, and innovating them in a way that they bring capital to a more innovative, if you will, social impact space. Sitting next to me, I have Yuri Willemse, who's the managing director of Growfin, which is the leading growth finance company in Africa. Over the last 6 years, Yuri and his team have aggregated over $250 million that will be placed through services and risk capital to small and growing businesses in Africa and elsewhere. The combination of risk capital and business assistance is really the innovative element of the growth finance tool that Yuri and Growfin apply to create viable small and growing businesses. I've had the opportunity to work with Yuri over the years, and I can guarantee that one of the things you'll hear in his remarks is the vision, commitment, and the untiring focus to the long-term capital strategy that's necessary to grow not just an intermediary investment company, but also those small and viable businesses on the ground. A second on my experience, I've been with Ian Co. for the last 15 years, and we also provide business developments and capital to small growing businesses who are focused exclusively in the area of clean energy. And our work is both in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And it's a very interesting topic for me right now, and I actually look to learn not just from the speakers, but also from yourselves, because Ian Co. is at a very interesting inflection point. We're registered as a U.S. nonprofit, which restricts the kind of capital that we can bring, yet we're at a point of taking our experience base and taking it to scale. So what does one do? Do you morph into a for-profit company? Do you create a fund with a capital F? Do you create a holding company? How do you increase the aggregation of capital so that we're able to focus on our mission and bring clean energy and energy access to the parts of the world who are unserved? It really is the fundamental element. So for me, when I was working with Dan on the development, I felt like I was actually living this, not just in terms of preparing for this session, but also in terms of preparing my company for growth. So with that, what I'd like to do is ask Harold if he could please start. And I asked each of them to think about in their opening remarks, sharing with you some initial words of wisdom as social entrepreneurs themselves about how do we push beyond grant capital? How do we push beyond that philanthropic base that starts so many of our initiatives to grow your models and companies? And it was very much in that context that I said, what would you have told me 14 years ago if I came to you and said, I want to grow my social enterprise? So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Harold and ask him to kick us off. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Christine, and it's been a very kind introduction. I think part of the reason Christine gave me that introduction is I asked her if she wanted me to take off my shirt and show my bruises from 30 years of trying to get the World Bank Group to be a more nimble player in this field, and I don't know if she knew I was serious or not, so maybe that's what that was about. So I was kidding. I'm not going to show you the bruises. Anyway, thank you all for coming. This is a great opportunity. People often say, what did you learn in 30 years of doing what you did in the World Bank Group? So just following a little bit the progression of the time I spent, for maybe the first 20 years, I did $3 or $4 billion of investments, and probably that was 250 or 300 deals on which I was, let's say, the lead decision maker. And I liked it, and I learned a lot about investing in tough places, but it always struck me that we, and I think you've all seen this in a lot of emerging markets, there's just an awful, very, very hard to move the needle for the big international organizations. I was always feeling like I wanted to, you know, in Burundi, or there's just nothing we could do, and that bothered me. So for my sins, they sort of encouraged, and that's to IFC, very much to IFC's credit, I started doing in Eastern Europe some of these early microfinance deals. And I remember some of them were with a fellow called Zeitinger at ProCredit, who's now one of the biggest players in the field. And so I started doing a lot of microfinance and some of the earlier ones for IFC. It taught me a lot of things about sort of how that field has developed. And I was, I guess, involved in some of the early stages of what are now a lot of the leading players like Finca and Action. A couple things that really struck me was, first, all of them used grants smart subsidies and did it well, but there's very few of those microfinance institutions that didn't spend $1 million or $1.5 million of grants to build a sustainable organization. And of course, they were time-bound, they stopped after a period, and it worked well, and there was someone good to manage them. The other thing I saw is that as we put pools of capital together, which have now become ProCredit and AIM, these are now hundreds of millions of dollars, it really did change for the better the behavior and the skill set of those organizations. In other words, they went from being consultants, which when we started working with them, to now principals, and that made a very large difference. They always used grants to build the institutions, but there's a big difference when someone's also worrying about capital and getting it back, and I think that was a very big learning for me. Then I went on and did a lot of technical assistance work and ran a lot of that area for IFC. Also convinced me that that was critical to, as I said, move the needle in tougher places. There was very little that was developmentally and socially worthy that didn't need capacity building. And that was very hard, the blending. The grant money came from one sort of people and the investment capital from another. That blending, and especially adjusting the blend over time, that was very difficult. And all of this sort of led them to have me set up the SME department, which was a joint World Bank IFC group. And again, there we tried to do better models of providing small and medium enterprise assistance, meaning investment and capacity building. Still, those were, as I call them, real companies. They weren't particularly social, but it doesn't have to be social. Any business in a tough country is a good contribution to the economic development. Still, I felt with all of that it was very hard in a large, structured organization like that to be nimble. So this was what led me to do a spin-off, basically. IFC is still the biggest single source of funds, but we have about 10 other organizations, private foundations, high net worth individuals, governments that are funding the Grassroots Business Fund. We've also learned an awful lot in that, and I'll just go through this quickly because I think we'll talk more at the tables about this. It is infinitely harder to make the transition from, as I call it, social enterprise with a capital S to investable transaction, and I won't go into the reasons for that. Maybe we'll talk about it at the table, but it's grossly underestimated by most of the sources of capital, I believe. The difficulties of doing that partial genetic transformation from being a social business or a charity into a viable investable transaction. And that means that the kinds of capital that get provided and when and how is often done badly, let's say. I'd say the management problem, the underestimation of how thinly managed most social businesses are, it's another big problem. I see very few, even the relatively investable transactions are, let's say, have the kind of management and governance that one needs. So, and that's very hard because a lot of these organizations come from the faith-based or the charitable organizations, the ones at least that I work with. And again, that getting to a size and scale that'll allow you to bring in proper management and pulling yourself away from, let's say, the genetic code of your founding NGO, or that's also much, much harder, I think, than people estimate. We're struggling with it all the time. I'd say also this blending and adjusting this blend over time. It was an issue in what I did when I was with IFC. It's a much bigger issue now. I'm thinking of a lot of back to the microfinance groups, that the mix of grant money versus technical versus investment capital has massively changed. And that's a very hard thing when you do spot interventions and programs, which is what a lot of organizations do, to make that mix. Anyway, I think I'll wind up my contributions here, but just a final thought. I always try to put the Grassroots Business Fund in the category of the investment clients that I work with and apply the same principles. And again, I'm, let's say for my first period, I'm all funded with grants, but I know that's not going to let me be scalable. So I'm exactly going through that same transformation I mentioned about my clients. So I've had the luxury of a, let's say, a wad of grant money, as we say, to get started. I'm trying hard to be disciplined, but I can see myself how hard it is to be disciplined and to do the right things and to be a hard-nosed investor. And now I'm adjusting the mix, and we'll be raising non-grant money. But I am also committed to not defaulting into the easy part of the job, raising enough money that I'm pushed to do big and easy investments, and that's a lot of the risk when you take a lot of money relative to the mission you're trying to do. And that's one of the things I'm trying to be very disciplined about. But I see the risk that if you have pressure, and I don't want to structure myself, at least as a management fund, too quickly, because I know what happens, and I've invested in plenty of those funds. It is very hard not to, let's say, start going up on your average project size and to start doing less developmental deals, because if you're just living off a 2 or 3% management fee. So my commitment is that I'd rather stay smaller and be transparent about the need for subsidies, even at my level, a reducing proportion, than to go right into being a fund. And, you know, so that's kind of my own, how I incorporate all these learnings together. let me just also give one small shout out to, I see Mildred here from CEF, and going back 10 or so years when I started the SME department, a very good example when we gave a little bit of, well, it was close to $1 million in that case, but a serious startup capacity building money for them. And I believe now they're also in that category of $600 or $800 million worth of investment. She's a very good example of someone who, a smart subsidy at the beginning, and now they are a very strong and commercially minded fund manager. I think this is an example of what you can do if you're smart about, you know, not letting the financial consideration take you away from your mission. Let me just stop there and say thank you again.
Great. Thank you, Harold. A couple of points that I took away from Harold's comments, which I think will come through our continuing conversations, is the issue of blending capital. How do you really look at taking those subsidies or those grants, blending them, but just as importantly, being transparent about how those grants and those subsidies are being applied to your business now and to your growth strategy. The other two elements that are, I think, critical are the nimbleness, which is basically one of the main characteristics, I believe, of an entrepreneur. But how nimble are you in creating your business and figuring out where to from here? The discipline that's necessary in understanding what your business is. And then one that I know many social entrepreneurs really struggle with is, how do you stay true to your genetic code? How do you really maintain the missionness of your organization as you seek to scale and you're getting continuous pressure to go bigger, faster, higher? So with that, I'd like to go to someone who's gone bigger, faster, higher. Bim, if we could ask you to please share your thoughts.
That's a daunting introduction. Thanks, Christine. Let me just start by thanking everybody for attending, and for thanking Skoll for inviting Lionshead to be part of this. I'm going to pick up on a theme that Harold mentioned about blending just before I get into the main point I was going to make. You know, we at Lionshead tried to do a transaction about, I guess it was about 9 months ago, where we were looking to buy a business which was socially motivated, initially out of a multinational. And the way we were going to finance it was to try and blend commercial capital, which is essentially going to be our own capital with socially motivated investors. And in the end, we had to give up because we couldn't blend the two into one transaction. I think that's kind of a stark example. And often when we've had conversations in audiences of this type, the holy grail that everybody looks for are transactions where you can create capital structures or financing plans where you blend the social and the commercial capital into one transaction. I think over time this will be possible. I think maybe we're in the early stages of the development of a market which is being created. But certainly as we stand right now, the objectives of the two pools of capital seem to be so distinct, and the metrics which exist around the social capital seem to be almost so onerous that it's very difficult to get them into the same room as commercial capital. So I just offer that as one sort of live example of where, and maybe we failed because we didn't do the right things, but certainly one example of where it was difficult to get the two pools of capital into a single deal. The other thing I'll mention is that we ourselves, Lion's Head, is raising money right now for a fund to invest in African agriculture, where each investment has to have a proven social case attached to that investment. So we have some live experience relating to what different pools of capital are saying with regards to how much they have to invest, what their criteria are, et cetera, and I'm happy to share those with people in the course of our conversations after the initial introductions. I just wanted to make four points, really, and I guess the first one is whether you are a social organization or a commercial organization, if you're looking for money, the first thing to do is put yourself in the place of the investor. And in doing so, your marketing tool is really your business plan. The fact that you are a social organization doesn't take away from the fact that you need a coherent and marketable business plan. And it needs to make sense in the context of what your mission is, what you're trying to achieve, and what size of business you're trying to build. If you're trying to get beyond two people, you need to explain how that team's going to be built, how it's going to be funded, where you're going to get the people from, and how you're going to keep that team together over a period of time through the various ups and downs that any business will face. And related to that is the financing plan. Even if you're an NGO, you still need a financing plan. Your financing plan may be such that you need to go to donors to get all the money, but essentially you need to figure out that's the best source of money for your particular business. And if you want to move away from that, which pockets of commercial capital you want to market yourself to such that your business is attractive to them and that your business can withstand the sort of charges and costs that those pools of capital would need to charge to make their money available. And I think those are critical points. And we've seen quite a lot of businesses come to us looking for assistance in terms of fundraising, but they've really failed to understand those two fundamental points. One is how to put together a coherent business plan, but then how to attach that to a financing plan which makes sense for their particular business. And I guess then the last point I just want to make is, even when you have the divide of social capital and commercial capital, it's not sort of a clear-cut divide between the two. Once you get into the commercial capital world, there are many sources of commercial capital, from banks to private equity to hedge funds, high net worth individuals, etc. And I think you need to understand the criteria for each particular pool of capital, what risk return criteria they have, what type of money they're able to make available to you in terms of is it short term, is it long term, and what's the most suitable for you. It's a continuum of capital, but each one has different criteria and different. And you need to do, I guess you need to have different business models which can make you attractive to those pools of capital. So I'll leave it there, just a few points to introduce the discussion.
Thank you, Bim. Yuri, you want to jump in?
Thank you, Christine. I think where I would like to start is to think about, how do you look at the market and your solution for the market, and, how does that drive the eventual business that you actually set up, be it a non-profit or a for-profit. When we looked at our business opportunity a couple of years back, I think the first thing that struck us that if you look at the financing landscape at this point in time, and specifically in an environment like Africa, then microfinance is quite well developed. The private equity side of things is also quite well developed. But there's a big gap for risk capital between microfinance and private equity. So you would find that an entrepreneur, and you know, we've been there in a number of occasions, when you want to go and raise money on the basis of viability, that very few people will help you if you need $100,000, $200,000, $500,000, say up to $1 million. In reality, in most countries, that space is totally unserviced. So I think it's easy to then look at that and to say, you know, globally, there is a big opportunity in the market. There's an unserviced area, and you need to come up with a solution for that. However, the solution has been a difficult one. You know, over the last 20 years, many banks through guarantee funds and many other examples of trying to set up small funds have tried to service that space. And as we know, most people lost a considerable amount of their capital, not even thinking about making a return. I think where we started, and I think that's one of the key points that I would want to make, is sometimes we look at some of these development problems and want to solve them from a development angle and not so much from a customer point of view. I think one of the things that we managed to get right in our business is having been on the customer side of it for many years and having been an entrepreneur that tried to raise funds, I think our view on what is needed in the market was different. So we didn't get blinded by just the development problem and that, but trying to first of all start from a customer centricity point of view, getting a customer solution in place. So our whole business was centered around what is the customer need in the market. And we started the business model from that point. First get a solution for the SME. And from that grew the solution of making both risk finance and business development assistance available. Because if you only give a client risk finance, then purely putting money on the table doesn't solve his problem of how to run his business. And we see it every single day when we get business plans that most business plans start with this beautiful vision where it will be in 5 years' time, connected with some financials that show all the profit. In reality, that's not what we're interested in. We're interested to see how are you going to get there? How are you piecing that together? And when Bim talked about a finance plan and a business plan, I think those are the critical elements. And in the businesses that we're setting up here, be it a for-profit or non-profit, it's that operational plan and that customer centricity that's extremely important. Now, very much part of that customer base that we've got is your investors, whether it's shareholders, whether it's grant funders, whether it's equity providers to funds. You always have to serve these two customer bases. In our case, it's the SME clientele, which is critical, but so too our investor base. Now, when we looked at that customer base of the capital providers, we segmented that customer base into the different groupings. So grant funders, the people that's prepared to take a lower than normal commercial return, and then commercial returns. I think the first thing you need to know is none of them would like to know that their money subsidizes any of the other providers of capital. So do not use a grant funder's money to subsidize a commercial return. That's definitely not on. Nobody wants to see their money being used like a tax. What you then need to do is to really look at how do you piece that different landscape together to actually get to where you are? And I think one of the key things that's important is that the focus is then not on how do you serve the customer, but how do you build an intermediary that can serve that customer? And how do you take those different capital groupings together or different capital providers? How do you piece them together so that you can actually build an organization that can deliver the service? And in our case, we really used a rather little grant funding, about $10 million, to then raise $260 million. And that $210 million is largely focused on building operations and systems to actually mobilize the $260 million. So also taking your vision and really building an operating plan according to a timeline of how do you put the money into the market. Where we are at this point in time, we set out 6 years ago to come up with a scalable solution for risk finance in emerging markets. We wanted to to play a lead role in how to develop the sector and develop a new asset class that fits in between microfinance and private equity. And Grow Finance is now at the point where there's several people that are following a similar model to what we have. We see a market in the near future that's a couple of billion dollars in capital. We've raised $280 million to date. We set ourselves a target to be a $1 billion company in the next by 2020. And we're taking a stepped approach of how to build the business in that way. But you need grant funding. We still solve a development problem, but we are developing a commercial asset class. And that's the blend that you need to work with. So although you're a commercial business with big commercial aspirations, with major development benefits flowing out of this, in the first 200 investments we've made, you know, there's 6,000 employees in those companies, 40,000 people go to bed at night having received benefits from those employees in a family context. So there's major development benefits, but you have to focus on the commercial aspects to get the development benefits. And from that, I think I'll finish off and to say, I many a time see that there's not a good balance between the development side of things and the commercial side. Many a time when I see business plans where people ask you to give input, they're so blinded by writing it from a social and development perspective that the real world of how things work and the operational side and the commercial side sometimes fall by the wayside. So getting a very good balance between the financial, social, development and environmental aspects is important. And the financial side is extremely important. Otherwise, you just do not have a story that's going to resonate with everybody.
The question was the $10 million that you received your grant monies?
Yeah, that was literally grant money that we received that you whether we burned in the process of setting up the operation and getting us to a break-even point, yeah.
What I liked about the way Yuri's comments built on Bim's comments is first Bim talked about the continuum of capital from grants through, if you will, lower return commercial capital and then commercial capital. And then Yuri talked about basically the financing gap in the market where you looked at microfinance and then private equity and that's SME or small and growing business space having needs. And I think it's the layover of blending that a lot of the work in this room and certainly up at this table is attempting to achieve. How do you blend the capital across the continuum of availability, the sources of funds, and how do you apply that blended sources of fund capital to the needs in the market where there are certainly gaps or the missing middle, which is often how the small and growing business space is defined. At this point, what we'd like to do is, again, this is the different session today, not our normal question and answer session, is we're going to break up into four small conference room-like tables, except we're all going to be in the same room. And the topics that, there are so many topics, we started with 10, and we thought that was a little bit much. So we've narrowed it down to 4. And based on the dialogue that we've had, the 4 that we think are ones that really impact across the spectrum of social enterprise growth is the issue of investment readiness. How do you know when your social enterprise is investment ready for more commercial capital? The second is trade-offs. What are the trade-offs, if any, between social impact and financial return? Should there be trade-offs? What does that mean? The third is structure. What are the types of structures as you seek to grow your social enterprise that you should look at? Oh, I have a slide. There we go. What are the structures? Do you stay a nonprofit and look to blend capital through the nonprofit vehicle, or do you seek to align or morph into a for-profit structure, and what does that mean to all those issues of your DNA, your mission, your genetic code? And the last category is the decision criteria. What are the key elements, the key criteria you should be looking at, the questions you need to know you don't know, or at least answer as you take the decision to transition up the scale of social finance into commercial finance. So if you've wondered what those placards are on the table, those are the topic tables. And what I'd like you to do is take a couple of moments to play musical chairs and find yourself at the table that you would like to have a dialogue about. We're each going to join you, one of us at each of your tables, and then we're going to speak, have a table-like discussion for about 20, 25 minutes, and then we, myself and the speakers, will summarize the main points from that dialogue and then come back and report to the group. So if I could ask you to take a moment and reflect on what conversation you'd like to join, and then situate yourselves accordingly at the tables, and we'll join you momentarily. Thank you. Hello. I'm sorry to interrupt what I assume from the quietness in the room of some very good conversations and people listening intently, but I need to call my speakers back. Come home. Harold?
I don't think we've reached any conclusions.
Harold? Okay, if I could ask us just to quiet down, we have about 11 minutes to have four topic table report backs. Okay, we're going to start. The first, when I think about the order, the sequencing of these topics, I'm going to suggest we report back in this way. First, decision criteria. What are the things you're thinking about or having to analyze when you make this decision to potentially change your capital structures or your model? The second that I would go to is the investment readiness. After you've taken those decisions or gotten that information base, what do you need to do? What do you need to know to be investment ready? What does that mean? The third would be the structure. After you've had decisions, you've decided on a structure, you've decided you're investment ready, what's the structure? How are you going to take your social enterprise and craft it from a legal personality or an operating perspective to raise capital? And then what I'm leaving for the end is probably one that is going to be still many years away from true decision or rationale, which is, what is the trade-off? Are there trade-offs when you start looking to focus on the social impacts of your business? What does that mean for the financial return, and what does that mean to the real traditional investment community? I had the pleasure of sitting with colleagues at the decision criteria table, and I'm going to very briefly summarize, and this is really meant to be a summary of bullet points. Certainly, we don't have enough time for a full disclosure of what went on in the dialogue. I think the first thing that a social entrepreneur has to decide as they're thinking about scale is, who's their client? If they scale, are they leaving that client base behind? It goes to Yuri's point about being customer-centric. Who do you want to serve, and what kinds of capital an operating model do you need to put in place so you maintain the focus on who that client is? The second is, if you're providing a service or you're creating entrepreneur investment platforms, do you need to control your investment capital? Are there ways that you can scale that business service, that advisory service, that, if you will, origination of investment opportunity without having to put the commercial capital in place yourself? What are the linkages, what are the partnerships that might need to be formed, and the opportunities represented not just here in this room, but in this growing social enterprise space? The third is one that I feel very strongly about myself, which is, what are the shared values that you have with the new sources of capital you're speaking with? It goes to the point that Harold made. Is there genetic DNA sharing? How are you going to control the missionness, the mission bounds of what you're doing? And what's the kind of due diligence that you need to do on those potential new investors and partners to give yourself confirmation that the folks that you're inviting into your home, something you've nurtured for all these years, is going to be respectful of what that missionness is. And the last point, whether you are a nonprofit, whatever your legal personality, a nonprofit or a for-profit, you need a layer of equity. You need a layer of risk capital. If you're the nonprofit, that's grants, that's philanthropic funds. That's what, you know, that is what really creates the equity of an organization and allows you, it's your working capital, it's your investment in your support services. And obviously, if you're a for-profit company, it's equity in the more true traditional sense of equity investing. So with that, that was the summary of our table. And once we've decided we're going to make a go and we're going to grow our social enterprise, we have to then decide if we're ready for investment. Harold.
Okay, thanks, Christine. So we had a good talk about investment readiness and came up with a number of points. First was, I think, just management and especially mid-level management in the organization is seen to be a problem just about everywhere. So there are a number of organizations. We had someone from Engineers Without Borders at the table, and trying to source it locally was another idea, but the general heading being management is a big gap, and especially below the top management, finding that, especially in organizations that are thinly funded, a problem. So that getting that addressed is part of investment readiness. Second point was incentives for changes. In other words, trying to get the local founder, leader, or creator to actually see the need and feel it, to change the organization's modus operandi, to become ready for investment, especially if they've come from, let's say, the social side. The feeling at the table was that our normal approach to seconding a gringo from far away into these organizations seldom sticks. So building those incentives into the local organization was important. There's an interesting thought. The third one was investor readiness. In other words, we think about investment readiness as the problem is all by the receivers of the funds, but I can say this being one, that it was a very good point that us types being ready to invest and knowing what it entails and what the pieces and phases are was a pretty serious part of the investment process, getting these organizations ready, that us, the investors, being ready. Fourth one was access to market, and that really had two sides. One was just the market for people, but that as a step towards regular product markets. So just access, helping these organizations get to where they are able to access markets, both for the managerial talent and for their products. The fifth point we had was management and by numbers and metrics. In other words, especially making metrics useful managerially and not just plying the providers of funds with information for their donors. So, making metrics consistent, workable, and useful for management, as well as giving us, the investors, the information we need, and also, helping organizations manage the numbers and have proper metrics was another point. Proof of concept was thought to be another important element. In other words, getting the organizations to the point where not just technically they've proven their concept, but in terms of their business model and their financial viability is another key element. And I think the role of the local community was brought up as maybe that's a part of that, if you can have the local communities where these organizations are present and working as part of the business model, the concept is much better proven and established and has roots in the local economy. And then the last point we had was something like an operational plan. We often talk about business plans, but I think the emphasis here was the operations, just the basic blocking and tackling of getting to their objectives. What are they going to do tomorrow and next week and next month? And the thought that maybe we could somehow map the hurdles that they face in getting to that.
Great. Thank you, Harold. Yuri, if you could next. Yuri said we just ended a moment or two early before that table solved all the problems. So if you need to reconvene to solve the problems outside, please do, because we're looking for those solutions on structures. Please share.
I think the bottom line of the discussion on our table is structure follows strategy. And I think that is critical. Many times people do not follow proper strategic planning and then making a decision on what structure they should have. And that structure is many times chosen on the basis of, what money is available, or are there grant funders available to support this, or are there other capital available to support that. And then you go down that route and then have to change over time or get stuck in a situation where the structure is actually not befitting of what you want to do. So really going through a very thorough strategic planning exercise, taking your vision into consideration, where is it that you want to end up, what is the mission you're going to follow, go through the whole business planning exercise, looking at the landscape of who's the funders that's out there. How can you segment that funders to support you in the different elements of your business, and then making the correct decision in terms of what is the best structure for your business, be it then for-profit or non-profit or even a hybrid model, is then critical. It doesn't matter whether you're a for-profit or a non-profit. The managing of the relationships that you have between your different funders is extremely important. Grant funders have different expectations than what your commercial funders or semi-commercial funders have. And you as the entrepreneur have to manage that relationship. All of these people will all feel that they are subsidizing the other. And it's very important that you as the entrepreneur clearly segment your business and or your organization and show each of those what are they subsidizing, and that they're not necessarily subsidizing each other, but subsidizing a specific part with a specific outcome. And I think that is critical. The other element that we discussed is that transparency is extremely important, and especially so if you're a for-profit business in the development world. There is this old thing where non-profits do not necessarily trust for-profits, and for-profits do not take non-profits seriously. And I think, again, as an entrepreneur, you have to manage those relationships within the business. And one of the best ways to do that is through absolute full transparency. Even when you're already in a for-profit status and actually making profits, but still need grant assistance to solve some development issues or build your business further to give a better development result, you know, that transparency only helps everybody to see where are you, why do you need assistance, and what is that assistance going to bring from a development perspective. So transparency, if you want to be a for-profit in a development world, is extremely important, and vice versa. I think those were the key points that we discussed.
Great. Thank you, Yuri. So, Bim, we've made our decisions on what we need to know. We've determined we're investment ready. We've put our management team in place. We figured out our structure, where we're going to sit along the continuum of nonprofit or for-profit. Are we making trade-offs?
I think we had a pretty healthy debate, but I'm not sure we completely agreed on whether there's a trade-off or not. But, you know, ideally, what we agreed on was ideally we don't think of it as a trade-off, but actually just as a return, which is adjusted for the nature of the business and the business opportunity. That's the ideal. Having said that, I think given where we are today, and maybe it's the development of this market or the way the markets think about this particular space, in today's market, clearly investors think of it as a trade-off. The donors, when they're giving donations, and if they're giving it to a commercial enterprise, say, are you making too much money? The commercial guys say, am I giving up return in order to have these social benefits? Part of the frustration or part of the challenge here is actually there's a lack of information or metrics which allow for the transparency, which some of the others alluded to here, which allows people to make what they would like to do, which is to make sort of a judgment within an infrastructure which is readily accepted by the marketplace. So I think what we identified was a real need for information which is readily available, readily accepted, which could be used by investors to assess how these returns need to be adjusted or risk adjusted or socially adjusted or whatever the trade-off metrics need to be. That leads on to the question of track record. I think people feel it's difficult in this market to understand what is the return which is justifiable for any particular business, and are they essentially for the incremental social benefits, are they accepting something which is less than the the market rate of return. There's not enough information as to whether, say, an agriculture project in Africa should be different to an agriculture project in other parts of the world. I think the social entrepreneurs would like more information regarding that type of thing. I guess those were the main points. And sorry, the last point is that actually the conversation needs to be adjusted for which type of investor you're speaking with. Different investors will approach this question from different perspectives.
Great. Thank you very much. I think the richness of both the reports back and the various conversations I saw going on leads me to think we probably could have extended this into a double session for all the intelligence and interest and enthusiasm in the room. I would just like to close with something that I think is critical for all of us, which is language. I think we've all lived in the world of silos, whether you're dealing with health or water or energy, or whether you're dealing with philanthropic capital, impact investing, commercial capital. And I think it behooves us as an industry to realize that for us to really change the paradigm and to get the kind of capital that we all know is necessary to address the development objectives that most of us in this room have, we have to begin to morph our language to the sources of capital. Not morph our mission, but morph our language, so that we're beginning to talk more in the language of what investors are looking for, and that the education process, the translation process, the transparency becomes part of that language metamorphosis that we're going through. So I throw out to you that 5 to 10 years from now, let's not wait 5 to 10 years before Rachel Kite has to translate what we're saying when she goes in to talk to her business divisions in the IFC. So I challenge you all to help us morph and translate our language. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the conference.